Evening to all of you. You have been such friendly and welcoming and gracious folks. We have enjoyed being among you very, very much. We'll return to Faith Builders greatly encouraged by your faith and walk with Christ. And I invite you to come visit us. We'd be delighted to have you come. And in fact, I'll just point out that on the table in the back, there's two postcards, and they are different. One has pictures on, the other one doesn't. And what these are about are open houses that are coming up. There's one in April, one in November, and these are great times for you to visit if you'd like to get up close and personal to the work at FB. Also, while I'm taking care of housekeeping things, on the table in the back, is that where they are, Brother Gary? Okay.
It'll be wherever you tell us.
Okay. They're at the, in the back, there is a stack of handouts that goes along with these sessions. It's a summary of the six emphases and some of the practices, the texts, and so on for each one. So if you're interested in that, you can pick that up on your way out. We're attempting to describe some of the emphases that characterize the Anabaptist worldview. And it is now time for a quiz. So the B stands for
brotherhood.
The S, first S,
submission.
And the second S,
separation.
And the third S,
sacrificial love.
Ah, you got it. Very good. The fifth word is, actually, wait on that for a moment, because I'd like to give you a quote. This is from a Baptist minister. Oh, I wasn't going to say Baptist. It's from a minister. You can get your thinking straight or your living right, but not both. The gospel is about getting your thinking straight. What do you think? Which is most fundamental? To obey Jesus or to understand Jesus? You know, I'm hearing some things out there. Just You know what's fascinating is I have asked this question in classes over and over and over again. And in general, now this is not an absolute rule, but in general, the older people say obey. And the younger people, at least when we start the discussion, say understand. You see, they say, how can you obey if you don't understand? And that makes sense, doesn't it? Of course, the older ones say, well, what good is understanding if you don't obey? Now, let's clarify that I'm not asking here which one of these is important and which one isn't. Clearly, both are important. Both are significant. I'm asking us to think about which of the two is more basic, more fundamental, more of an end in the language we've been using here this week, which is a first thing. And to expand the question, see, is commitment or comprehension more fundamental? Belief or reason? So I'm just adding some words to both categories to help us think about the two sides here. And just so we know we're getting our money's worth, I'll put some fancy smancy words up here. Is orthopraxy or orthodoxy, more fundamental. Ortho meaning right, praxy, practice, doxy, doctrine, truth. Right doctrine or right practice, which is more fundamental? Heart or mind? The person who lives well, the person who thinks well. The saint or the scholar? Living or thinking? Now, if this was a classroom setting, we would just stop right here and probably work on this for the next hour. But it's not, and so we'll keep moving. Although I am remembering a conversation from the I taught when I teach this material, it's different. Here it feels much more like preaching, and I've told a couple of you that I feel much more comfortable in an interactive setting than this. But in the class that I just finished teaching in winter term, two of the students really got into this one. And I wasn't quite sure what was going to happen until it was all said and done. But, okay, which is the first thing, which is second? Anabaptists emphasize living. Anabaptists point to verses like, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. And notice that it doesn't say, if you love me, you will think correct thoughts about me. James 1:22, but be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. Or from James chapter 2, what good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can that faith save him? If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warm, filled, without giving them the things needed for the body, what good is that? So also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. When I say that Anabaptism emphasizes living, I mean we believe that daily, ordinary obedience evidences and shapes our love for God. Daily, ordinary following of Jesus gives evidence of our love for God. It also actually gives shape to it, or it cultivates it. It produces it. Anabaptism emphasizes living. Now, I'm sometimes asked why the list of six emphases that I lay out does not include two things. Why doesn't your list include Christ or Christ-centeredness? And why doesn't it include biblicism? Because in quite a few lists of Anabaptist emphases, both of these would be listed there. However, the reason I don't, here's why. Most Christian groups say they're Christ-centered, and most say they're biblical. They're anchored in the scriptures. And so what I try to do here is understand how Anabaptism applies those focuses. And so I explored, if you remember, on the session on separation, I explored Christocentricity in that session. And now I'm suggesting that it is the Anabaptist claim to biblicism is best seen here in our emphasis on living. So I'm saying that these two emphases, being Christ-centered, being biblicist, are here, but they're under different categories or using different emphases to include them. Two of my favorite quotes from the early Anabaptists speak of this emphasis on living. The first from Hans Denk: "For whoever thinks he belongs to Christ must walk the way that Christ walked." You hear the emphasis on living. And that from Minna Simons: "For true evangelical faith cannot lie dormant, but manifests itself in all righteousness and works of love. It clothes the naked, feeds the hungry, consoles the afflicted, shelters the miserable, aids and consoles all the oppressed, returns good for evil, serves those that injure it, prays for those that persecute it." Anabaptism agrees with Soren Kierkegaard when he writes, "Although the scribes could explain where the Messiah should be born, they remained quite unperturbed in Jerusalem. They did not accompany the wise men to seek him. Similarly, we may be able to explain every article of our faith, yet remain spiritually motionless. The power that moved heaven and earth leaves us completely unmoved." What a contrast. The three kings had only a rumor to go by, but it spurred them to set out on a long, hard journey. The scribes, meanwhile, were much better informed, much better versed. They had sat and studied the scriptures for years, like so many college professors, but it didn't make any difference. Who had the more truth, those who followed a rumor or those who remained sitting, satisfied with all of their knowledge? Anabaptists emphasize living. Every 5 years, we have our courses there at Faith Builders evaluated by a team of college professors. So we were invaded by 15 to 20 college profs that they look over all of our coursework and they evaluate whether it is college level. And in those conversations that we have with those with that review committee, and by the way, some would be from Christian colleges, quite a few are not. But inevitably, the question comes, now, how do you choose your teachers here? Because the only way we know to choose teachers is to use credentials and to check credentials. And we notice that you have a teacher or so on staff that doesn't have the kind of credentials we'd expect. How do you choose? And we tell them that we look for people who know the subject that needs to be taught. We care about that. But then we say, but more significantly than that, we look for people who can genuinely teach on a college level. We want to see capability and skill. But is it really the most significant for us? Is that we look for people who are and who live like what we would like for our children and for our students to become. Anabaptists emphasize living. Daily ordinary obedience evidences and shapes our love for God. Don't just tell me, show me, is the logic of this emphasis. Perhaps one of our favorite sayings as a people is, the proof is in the pudding. Or as it should be said, the proof of the pudding is in the tasting. Someone has observed that while Protestants learn to live by thinking, Anabaptists learn to think by living. So what picture could we give for this? What picture can we give to show this emphasis on following Christ in daily life? Traditionally, this emphasis has translated into working together as families and as a church community. And so I've chosen a farm work scene as a picture for this emphasis. We're a people that in the past have been deeply connected to the land. And that has given us opportunities, many opportunities for shared work. It's in these daily rhythms of life, of eating together, working together, of living, that the fabric of faithfulness of God is woven. This is where I learned what it means to follow Christ. Pulling weeds in the cornfield, shelling peas, taking care of the animals, hearing my dad and older brothers talking to the salesman. I have so many memories of actually seeing what it means to follow Christ lived out. I'm thinking of a time when we were rounding up heifers, and it seemed like that was a time when Dad got extra tense. And I guess he kind of knew all of the things that could go wrong. And but on this one occasion, as we were rounding things up, and Dad was kind of giving orders, and the three of us boys were doing our thing or trying, something happened, and all of a sudden a bunch of the heifers took off, and Dad really let us have it. And he was angry, and we could feel it. We heard it. But you know, it probably wasn't more than an hour or so that he got us together and said, boys, I need to say something. He said, what happened back there a while ago was not right. And I'm sorry. You know, I learned some years later that Dad's dad really struggled with anger. And you know, I never saw that in my father that much. I saw it occasionally. But I'm convinced it was Dad's willingness just to come and talk to us about it and say I'm sorry that made a big difference. Following Jesus was translated into the warp and woof of life. Living. Anabaptists emphasize living. We're losing the benefits of families working together. We can't go back. We can't go back to an agrarian life, but we should put a lot of energy into creating meaningful opportunities to work together as families and church communities. And I would just call us to that again. We should put a lot of energy into creating meaningful opportunities to work together, not just as families, but also as churches. What are the practices that cultivate this emphasis on living? The first one I'll mention is eating together as a family. For many Anabaptists, the dining room table, the kitchen table, rather than the church sanctuary, is the iconic meeting place. While this seems to be changing somewhat, Anabaptists have traditionally protected mealtimes. Coming to the table in gratitude to God, enjoying the provision of food, discussing the day, reflecting on what's important, talking together about the latest news, working over the tough issue that's bugging someone, just being together. We're demonstrating the importance of living faith. A second practice that nurtures this value of living is close communion. Now, I'm not even totally sure what the practice is here. Some make the case that communion should be offered to anyone who's a follower of Jesus. In this view, it's inappropriate to refuse the emblems to someone that God has accepted. From this perspective, refusing communion to someone is equivalent to telling them that they are not of Christ. And of course, we know this view is open communion. On the other hand, most conservative Anabaptists practice a form of close communion. And in this approach, communion is open to those whose lives are lived close enough to be observed, close enough to experience. And so instead of communion being a time to make discernments about everyone who asks for it, close communion limits the discernment to the people we know well enough to evaluate. Close communion recognizes that there are many followers of Jesus outside of the church, outside of this church, outside of my church. It's not making a statement about who is and who isn't a Christian. It's identifying those who have committed themselves to this body of Christ or a church close enough so that we can have confidence that they too are in submission to the church. Close communion, I'm offering, is a practice that identifies us as a people that care deeply about living and not merely believing. And now for a story. One of the classes that I took at Columbia International University was called Evangelism Explosion. And in this class, we memorized a 30-minute presentation of the gospel. Now, the presentation began with a diagnostic question. Now, you see, what this is about was preparing us to go door-to-door evangelizing. And so that's what this 30-minute presentation was about. First of all, we go knock on a door, and we'd initiate some small talk, and then we would launch into the diagnostic question. And the diagnostic question went something like this. If you were to die today and stand before God, and he were to say to you, "Why should I let you into my heaven?" What would you say? What would you say to God? What would your response be to God? Now, if the person was able to answer that question correctly, and there was one correct response, then you were free to move on. You could say, "Well, you know, it's hello, brother, hello, sister," and then you could say goodbye and go to the next house. If, however, they were not able to give the correct answer, then we would launch into our 30-minute presentation. I am not planning to give that here this evening. But the thing I want you to notice here is that depending on how a person answered, you could discern whether they were saved or not. That the discernment was based on whether you had the right understanding, the right idea, the right belief. The claim, I know whenever I do this in my class and I don't say any more, people are, "What's the correct answer?" The correct answer is, "I'm trusting in Jesus." The claim, and notice the presupposition here, that the claim that I'm trusting in Jesus for my salvation is assumed to mean the same thing as actually trusting in Jesus. Now, contrast that with the story that's often told of a plain dress dunkard that was accosted on the streets of a Pennsylvania town by an evangelical young man who probably had taken the course that I had taken. But he shortened it to, "Brother, are you saved?" And the dunkard man He cocked his head a little bit and thought about that. Didn't say anything for a moment. Was clearly thinking. And then he reached in his pocket and he pulled out a piece of paper. Still not saying a word. And he started writing on his piece of paper. And finally got done and he gave it to the evangelist. And he said, "Here, on this paper are the names and the contact information, the phone numbers for my wife, my children, and the people that I work with. Ask them if I'm saved. I could tell you anything." Anabaptists emphasize living. Now, this is a godly and good emphasis, but here too, we should be careful. And so, I want to offer three cautions. An overemphasis on living can reduce following Jesus to certain behaviors that form a shell without significant life. And we call this formalism. The form is more significant than the life in the form. Formism here. Living, and an emphasis on living can be reduced to mere doing, to mere behaviors, a performance without authenticity. Living, as I'm presenting it here, is not mere behavior. It includes being. It includes the heart behind the behaviors. And if we're not careful, we can put more energy into keeping up the appearances than in actual maturity. Yaroslav Pelikan put it this way: tradition is the living faith of the dead, while traditionalism is the dead faith of the living. I'll say that again. Tradition is the living faith of the dead, while traditionalism is the dead faith of the living. Sometimes tradition gets a bad name. It has some baggage sometimes, but it's not tradition that deserves the bad name. It's traditionalism. It's formalism. A body, a form, without life. A second caution for us here in this area, I'm putting under the heading of humanism, but I'm defining it in a particular way. Our emphasis on living can degenerate into overconfidence in our ability to follow Christ apart from his power. This is what I mean by humanism. Overconfidence in man's ability apart from Christ. Our call to practical Christian discipleship may rest on this assumption that I have, that you have what it takes to live up to Christ's standards. And so, if one of us is struggling with addictions or anger or lust, well, you just need to try harder. After all, Jesus wouldn't have commanded it if we couldn't obey it, right? But this view is significantly at odds with the New Testament teaching that our ability to obey Christ rests entirely in his grace. Outside of the grace of Christ, we don't have what it takes. And so an emphasis on living like Jesus can become a way in which we insulate and isolate ourselves from the power of Christ. A third caution. Anti-intellectualism. Again, our enthusiasm for living, and it's an appropriate enthusiasm. It's one of the reasons that I'm a convinced Anabaptist. But our enthusiasm for living can cultivate a suspicion of the life of the mind. Now, if I could go back to the very start, remember where we were wrestling with thinking and living? Go back to that. Understanding or obedience. Obedience, yes. Living, yes, is a first thing. Thinking, understanding is a second thing. And sometimes in our enthusiasm for the first thing, of obedience to Christ, of living out our commitment to Christ, we can make an enemy of the life of the mind. We can separate the life of the mind, thinking, from living. In this view, thinking becomes a barrier to true spirituality. The life of the mind is seen as optional, unnecessary for a robust Christianity. That's what I mean by anti-intellectualism. And I would say to you that another reason I'm a convinced Anabaptist is partially because it is intellectually credible. But I also have to acknowledge that it was an evangelical college that convinced me of that. Or that at least helped me to see that. Our lack of work in cultivating the life of the mind, and just to maybe to illustrate the point, I sometimes go down to our used bookstore there at the school, and I look at our Mennonite section, and then I look at the evangelical section, and you know, I walk away, generally just walk away saying Mennonites write pamphlets. Evangelicals write tomes. And that's the difference. I mean, you know, they write these thick books, and the Mennonites say there's just lots of pamphlets. So our lack of work in cultivating the life of mind, of articulating what we believe, what we value, has made us vulnerable to other theologies that on some levels seem attractive to us, but in at least in some cases don't describe our understanding of the gospel. One of the things that I hear from quite a few of our students at Faith Builders something along this line, that we're taught to live well. As we grow up in our churches and our homes, we're taught to live well, and we're so grateful for that. But we're seldom given the history, the context, the rationale to understand our way of life, or language to describe that way of life. An emphasis on living is appropriate, but living must not be divorced from loving God with our mind as well. Three cautions. Formalism, humanism, anti-intellectualism. So we've had five words now. Five Anabaptist emphases: brotherhood, living, submission, separation, sacrificial love. One to go. The D word. And as we close, I want to quote from two non-Anabaptists that, but because of our emphasis on living, would cause us to agree with what they have to say. The first one from Augustine. Now, whosoever supposes that he can know, understand truth while he is still living iniquitously is an error. And then from John Henry Newman, Obedience to the light we possess is the way to gain more light. Till we aim at complete, unreserved obedience in all things, we're not really Christians at all.